All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters, what the fuckaholics, what's happening? Oh, it's me, Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. Welcome. I'm happy you're here, as you can probably tell, perhaps, unless these mics are absolutely fucking amazing, which they might be, but you could probably sense the room is different. You can probably sense that perhaps tonally things are a little different. I am in probably, I'm going to go ahead and say, the second greatest city in this country. I'm not even going to go into why one is one or what one is. That's what a coward I am. But I'm in Chicago for a couple of days doing a thing. I don't even know if I can talk about the thing, but God damn it. I love Chicago. I shot my special in Chicago. For those of you who haven't seen that special, I know it's hard to find. I know it's hard to get, but go to epixhd.com and there's a way you could probably watch it. You might even have Epix, and they have it on the thing there at the demand place at epixhd.com. But don't worry, in a couple of months, it will be on Hulu and we can all watch it together on Hulu. A lot of people get the Hulu. Eventually, all will see it. More later with me, Mark Maron, taped right here in Chicago. That was the last time I was here. I'm here to do a Joe Swanberg thing that I'm not really supposed to talk about. But it's a pretty cool thing. I'm acting. I'm doing some, acting for me. I think I'm okay at acting the part of me. I can do it, on camera for Maron. I can also do it in other places, and I can do it where you can change the name. See, this is the trick of my acting technique, is that my technique is act exactly like yourself, give or take a little bit, turn this down, turn that up, if you can make those kind of adjustments, and then just have a different name for the character. And then if people say, like, well, he's not really acting, maybe they don't understand the character. That's how I justify and rationalize my acting technique. If you'd like to learn how to act, with the Mark Maron system, here it is. Just try not to be too self-conscious. Act like yourself. React to things honestly and listen. And then take some direction. Like, move over there, move over there. Can you do an accent? Probably not. I probably can't. But can you speak a little lower? Yeah, but you might have to remind me because I do a lot of mic work. Where you're not even supposed to speak loud, but it's an enunciation thing. But anyway, so I'm doing some acting, and I'm sitting here in my room. This is morning before my call time. And there are actors I'm acting with that I'm pretty excited about. There's people that I haven't met, but I'm going to be acting with Jane Addams, who it's very exciting to me because she's one of those actresses that I think I've met her, but I don't know. I'm just very familiar with her work. And I feel like I know her. And that happens a lot. That's one of the reasons I think that the podcast functions the way it does, is I have a peculiar familiarity with people I've seen once. But I guess the point I was trying to make, I'm also working with some young actresses. I'm working with Emily Ratajkowski, and I'm working with Alexandra Marzella, who is a performance artist. Emily is an actress. They both seem like lovely young women, smart, talented people. But the thing is, like, I don't know, like, Alexandra, I don't know what, she's a performance artist. And all I know is, I'll tell you this right now, I'm in my room right now doing this. I'm talking on the mic. I'm being as honest as possible. I don't feel great. I feel a slight nag of a buggy kind of, but, I'm not, that's between me and you. I'm just trying to, kind of suck it up and do the work. And she's probably in her room doing a naked Snapchat. I don't know what Snapchat is. It was just shown to me recently. And I don't know what this whole world of art is. I don't know this immediacy. I can't get involved with it. Am I a dinosaur? Am I almost extinct? Is my intellectual context almost diminished? Is it culturally completely irrelevant artistically? I mean, the woman I'm seeing, Sarah Kane, she's a a painter. I understand painting. I understand a beautiful abstract canvas. I understand the skill set that goes involved, that gets involved with that. But there's a whole world of technological expression, art, that I don't know, man. Maybe I got to get hip. Maybe I don't have time. But it's interesting to see it. I'm also working with David Pasquese, who's a Chicago guy who I've known. I have a couple of scenes with him. Why am I telling you all this? Am I just gloating? No, I got to tell you what's going on and exactly what is going on. Joe Swanberg is directing, and I love that guy. Maybe you guys heard me interview him. I think he's a great director, and he's very fun to work with. And today, you know, I have to act like I'm getting boozed up because it's Chicago. So today's show, speaking of art, speaking of performance art, Alexandra Marzella is the new incarnation of performance art. I was on the Lower East Side of Manhattan during the, I would think it is the tail end of what was the performance art scene of the 70s and 80s. I think it was sort of crashing down. My point is Eric Bogosian is on the show today. Eric Bogosian, the writer, actor, performance artist, playwright, one-man show inventor. I think it was Bogosian, you know, outside of theatrical presentations of maybe Hal Holbrook doing Mark Twain and some other stuff. I think that Bogosian can be credited for creating the modern one-man show and making us all feel that we could perhaps do a one-man show. I've talked to Bogosian a couple of times, and I've seen him several times. And he was one of those guys that, you know, when I was in New York, you'd see his books at St. Mark's Bookstore, and you'd be like, that guy's the guy, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, man. And Drinking in America, I think, was one of the other ones. And, you know, he was just a dude. He was a force down there. I think I saw Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll two or three times. Twice as a works in progress and once as a finished piece. And he was one of those guys where I was always sort of like, all right, this guy's really fucking good. He's got a lot of momentum. He's got a lot of power up there. He's good at the characters. But why isn't he just doing stand-up comedy? Because he's going for the joke. A lot of these characters are going for the joke. And of course, me as a younger man, I was like, that guy's just a comic that doesn't have the guts to go in the comedy club, where us men are doing stand-up comedy. You know, that was my attitude. And obviously, whatever he did for himself provided him a very wide buffet of possibilities to grow as a creative person, to the point where, you know, it's not out of nowhere because he's been working on it a long time, but he's written a book that talks about a little-known story in relation to the Armenian genocide called Operation Nemesis, about a bunch of, I believe, Armenians that lived in America who arranged the assassination of many of the architects and executors of the Armenian genocide. And Bogosian just went down that rabbit hole and started doing that work. Man, I'll tell you, there was a time where I tried to do the one-man show thing. I mean, some of you know that. But I remember when I did Jerusalem Syndrome, I got to be honest with you, man. I was like, I didn't know what the fuck to do. There's been so many junctures in my career that were sort of fueled by a desperation, a need to do something that, you know, could put me somewhere. I worked really hard on putting that one-person show together, Jerusalem Syndrome, which became a book. I used to do these fucking 2.5-3 hour shows at this little place called Nada 45. Me and Kirsten Ames, who was my director and dramaturge, just editing and recording and putting things together. And then we got a run at the Westbeth Theater. We had a set decorator, and it was like a big deal. It was like, you know, it was a big deal for me to not improvise, to stay on a script, to do actions when I was supposed to be doing actions, to make movements that were planned and written. It was ridiculously difficult couple of months I ran at West Beth. I don't know what I was thinking, but I got a New York Times review, and the guy was like, he seemed to like the show, I guess. But I think his note was, the character of Maron doesn't really transform. And I'd never gotten that out of that. I never got that out of my mind. That a theatrical performance, something that's called a piece of theater, there should be some transformation. I don't know whose fucking rule is that, or if that's just a rule that's something that happens in act at the end of act two or whatever. If it's not just about story, it's some sort of transformation. But you know, it was a fairly positive review. And at the end, he said, "We'll see what happens with this Marc Maron character." This is where one person's show ends up. This was the painful thing in a way where, you know, because it was Jerusalem Syndrome is roughly about a trip to Israel, but more about framing all of my weird obsessions and compulsions in some sort of spiritual context or religious context that, you know, I couldn't get a regular agent, you know, and I got a personal appearance agent that dealt with random people who did one person shows, Janine Frank. God bless her, does a great job. But I started booking Jewish community centers. Oh, man. I'm doing so much better. I don't know if you really know, you know, you really feel in your guts who you are and what you're doing and what it means and, you know, what you need to do to perhaps change your life when you're doing your off-Broadway show at a Jewish community center, you know, in Newton, Massachusetts. Or I, for like a half a house of people that were expecting something fundamentally Jewish and, you know, where you're cussing and you're doing your little bits to, you know, a lot of senior citizens, a few younger people. But needless to say, my friends, I've hit a few bottoms in this life. But now I'm in Chicago working with Joe Swanberg and some interesting people, and I'm excited. I talked to Bogosian about, I always bring it up, and we actually have I like Eric. I believe we are friends. The times we've spent together have been engaging and exciting. He's a very excited and manic and thoughtful and bright guy, and he's a creative guy, and he likes to talk, so it's great for me. So enjoy this conversation that I had with Eric Bogosian. I'm not in the garage right now, so there will be no guitar playing at the end. I don't even know why I'm telling you that now. I don't want you to get your expectations up. Eric's new book is called Operation Nemesis. It's available wherever you get books. All right, so this is me and Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. So did you rent that Mercedes?
Yes, of course. I have to. I'm Why? In Los Angeles.
Is that what your feeling was?
Yes.
Do you own it?
Because in L.A., if you show up and you don't have a nice car, suddenly you're like a second-class citizen. They know all about you.
I was driving a 2006 Camry for years, and I finally had that moment where I had to go to an event, and I pulled up to the valet, and I was like embarrassed. And yeah, I never thought about it before. Yeah. I was sort of like,
clean,
cluck it.
Too. You have to clean it.
I got to clean. I just got a new one. I can't clean it. I'm no good with it, and I already fucked it up.
I have a car in New York.
You do?
But it's totally covered with dust and
what kind crack. Of car is that?
Just a Toyota Highlander.
That you drive in the city?
With 150,000 miles.
Right. So what are you doing? Why did you come out here?
I have been coming back and forth here for about a few months because I wrote this book about an Armenian revenge conspiracy.
Operation Nemesis.
Yeah,
so you're out here on
a true story, true book, not a fictional book, a real, this is real history.
So at some point you sort of locked into this story and you're like, you're going to be a scholar. You're going to learn it. You're going to get to the bottom
yes,
of it.
Yes.
But that's a new thing, right, for you, really?
Yeah, and also something I didn't really plan on because this was going to be a screenplay like 7 years ago. Armenians were always saying, why don't you write something about the Armenian genocide? I'm like, what am I going to write? And then I heard about this young guy who had killed the leader of the Turks in Berlin in 1921 as a revenge against the Armenian genocide. And I thought, oh, this will make a movie. It should take me a couple of months to write it. I started. Yeah. It all made sense that he got acquitted because they felt that since he'd seen his whole family massacred, he had a right.
Yeah.
This is what he had said right. in court.
An eye for 10 eyes.
Yeah, yeah. And once I started doing research on it, you can get the court transcript online. The man's name was Sogomon Tetlerian.
Yeah.
Good luck with
doing
that.
Why don't you, the first hour of your research is spelling that. So have a good morning.
And learning how to say it.
Yeah.
And then I found out that, in fact, he was a member of a hit squad operating out of Massachusetts. There was this obscure book that came out of France that I found in translation.
Yeah.
And that it wasn't just him. There were a couple of dozen guys, and that they targeted all these Turkish leaders, and they knocked off six of these guys. Pretty much all the guys who committed the genocide were killed by Armenians 5 years after the genocide.
From Massachusetts?
Well, they were people all over New England. Massachusetts were the organizers. They were these small businessmen, and they recruited these gunmen, men who were like ex-military and other guys who were familiar with how to
handle it. But this was not sanctioned by the government of Armenia.
This is historically a little vague, but no, they couldn't sanction it because the government army, it was a very small
country.
But
was it like Munich?
Time.
Was it like the Israeli revenge for Munich? Was there some sort of covert operation within the government that said like, you guys, we're not saying do this, but go ahead if you have to.
It was more of something that a political group had decided that there had been devastation and different people were like, what should we do? Should we save the orphans? Should we raise money to get women out of Muslim bondage?
This is post-genocide. Now, okay, before we go too deep into it, because I live, you know, right here at Glendale and the Armenians are part of my day-to-day life, actually. And, you know, I hear about the Armenian genocide, but I'm ignorant of it. So is this something you grew up knowing about?
Oh, absolutely.
Now, what happened?
When I was a little kid, my grandfather used to sit and tell me stories when I was 5 years old. He'd say, if you ever meet a Turk, kill him.
Right.
I mean, these were the kind of things
that I grew
up on.
Give me the numbers and the events in a short way. What happened?
World War I, under the fog of war,
yeah.
the leaders of what was then the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish government, figured they can get rid of all the Armenians and when nobody's looking.
And take over that turf.
They could take their property.
Right.
They could take their position, their mines, their factories, and also get rid of them because they were Christians in a Muslim country. It's a horrible echo of what's actually happening right now over there. And so in 1915, 1916 were the big killing years. And the estimates are that over a million people were, and we're talking about civilians here. We're talking about women, children,
just going through the streets, shooting them, or actually camps. Or
well, they send out soldiers. If it's a small village, you just bring everybody. You just kill everybody,
right.
Or you kill all the men, cut their throats or whatever, and then send the women on a deportation caravan with their children, which goes into the desert, which you can't survive.
Uh-huh.
This is classic.
It's disgusting.
And so if they can possibly get to the place in Syria, which was where they were aiming them, which is this desert, and they might go in circles for weeks and then finally, you know, just wear them all out. Anybody who got there, they were concentration camps, and then they died there. as well in Der Zohar, which is in the news all the time.
Now, as a Jewish guy, you know, you grow up with these stories, you know, the never forget the Holocaust, you know, generationally, even if I didn't have family that died in the Holocaust, it was something that you were brought aware of culturally as a Jew. Yeah. So now as an Armenian kid, you're full Armenian.
Yeah.
So your grandfather would tell you this, these stories. He saw his family get killed, maybe.
Well, he saw things that he would tell me about. Like, they would get round up everybody into the church, lock the doors, and burn the church down with the people in it. And that was something that he told me about.
Terrifying as a kid.
I don't know what I made of it. It all seemed like it had happened very far away in a very... First of all, I had no idea. What is Armenia? Where is Armenia? Were we Middle Eastern? Did they ride camels there? Yeah, I didn't know any about that.
So but it was you like, grew up with these rituals and habits and foods, you know, and culture.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved being Armenian. In fact, you know, just trying to embrace my roots, which, to be honest... coming into this Hollywood thing in the 80s, and I have an agent saying, if you fix your nose and straighten your hair and change your last name, you have a future in this business.
Did they really say that?
Yes. He took me to the grill when I got signed at William Morris in 1983. He looked at me and said, you have a lot of talent. Just do these things.
But then right after you said no, did he say like, well, we'll cast you as a Jew?
That's been my job pretty much. I am the archetypical Jewish guy on everything I do.
Right, you did that Woody Allen movie.
Which
one was that? Where you played the brother-in-law?
Deconstructing Harry.
That was great.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, yeah. I learned a lot about acting doing that particular bit.
Really? From him? Because he's pretty hands-off.
No, I only had a few lines. I mean, I had a few pages with Carol and Aaron. And then I was like, today I'm not going to go to craft services and hang out all day and complain about my agent. I'm going to stay in my trailer and I'm going to just keep doing these 12 lines over and over again.
Right.
And he goes fairly slowly, lighting and everything. Uh-huh. And I was in there for like 6 hours. I already knew it when I got to set.
Going deep Jew.
And then I went, but I really thought about what are you really saying here? What's happening? And I had never really done that deep work before.
And it was a choice.
I bring it to everything I do. I say, wait a minute, you think you know this. You think you know your lines. You think you know what the scene's about. But stick with it. There's more here. You just haven't found it yet. And so that's been sort of a new part of my MO.
Right. So it's my assumption, like, you know, and looking over, you know, what I'm interested in about your life, that this project, this Operation Nemesis, for whatever reason, you went down this rabbit hole at a time in your life where I think it was probably important to you to connect with your heritage. And own it.
And also, like, enlarge my sense of who I am, which includes, like, who my grandparents are, what it means to be Armenian, and all this kind of stuff. Instead of sort of keeping it at arm's length, like, I'm a little...
Literally running away from it. Because I imagine, not unlike me, you know, when you're young and creative and you want to make your mark, there's a liability to, you know, getting hung up on tradition or your past, or you just want to be who you are. And do your thing.
Yeah, and I was that. I mean, I was one of the first mall rats in the United States. They built a mall near my home.
Where'd you grow up?
In Massachusetts, in Woburn. They built the Burlington Mall.
And yeah.
I used to just, me and my friend, we got busted there for smoking pot. I'm 62.
So I'm 50. All right. So 10 years before, that was the first mall. That was when it started happening.
So they didn't know when they built the malls that it would attract teenagers who would just go there and
spend
hang around.
Day.
Yeah. And we were in the parking lot smoking weed.
Yeah.
We'd actually just dropped acid as well. And the cops busted. I'm like, next thing I know, I'm in handcuffs.
Yeah, on acid.
Tripping on acid in a jail cell in Burlington. I'm actually trying to get my, what's the picture they do with the little number?
The mugshot.
The mugshot.
You can't get it? Can't find it?
I asked somebody to look it up for me.
So what year was that? So that was like 69?
That's late 71. 60. 71. So I'd just gone to college. I'd come back to hang out with my homies, and
you're going to college that first year. The entire culture is blown open by the 60s, and it's sort of just settling into just pure drugs and rock and roll.
I was like a junior version of that, because that was all happening when I was still in high school.
Well, that's what I mean. So the actual revolution was already subsiding and just now infiltrating pop culture in the form of music, so everybody could.
But I was already doing all that stuff. I mean, I started doing bad stuff when I was in high school.
Oh, yeah? And, what was the bad stuff then?
You know, acid.
Speed, acid, a lot of acid.
Acid, and I worked in a drugstore, which wasn't helpful. So,
but that was like the real acid, right?
Yeah.
That was the mythical kind of like, that was the real shit.
Well, we had, Woburn had bikers.
Woburn!
Yeah, so we would, I would grab a bottle of something, and I'd take it up to these guys.
Yeah.
And can I say this now? Is this like, am I going to get busted for doing it?
No, I think there's a statute of limitations fucking 50 years ago.
White Cross, you know, I'd find a bottle of White Cross, and I'd find these bikers, and they'd say, here, here's a bag of weed for that. And that's because that's all I wanted was just some weed.
So those are like Benny's almost. There was like the little white speeds.
Yeah.
You got to take like five of them.
And I loved hanging around those guys because they kind of protected me. I grew up in a town that, I mean, it wasn't, there were a lot of tough guys in my town.
I remember
and I wasn't tough.
Right.
So
right.
I needed the big guy.
And you were Armenian. So you're surrounded by these, like, you know, these New England townies, which are some of the hardest, most interesting people. I know guys that come from Woburn. I started doing comedy in all those towns.
Oh, yeah.
The satellite towns of Boston, all over New England. And it's intimidating. There's some intimidating cats out there.
Yeah. Well, I made sure I had one of them right now, because you'd be sitting there, you know, smoking weed at some party and having a drink. And there'd be some guy just watching you, glowering like, who's this guy?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, who are
you?
Who
the fuck are you?
Yeah, and then Mikey would stand up and go, he's okay.
He's okay.
With me. And then I wouldn't. Now, years later, Mikey took a bite out of me when we were in the middle of a fight.
Like a bite? Like a bite?
Yeah, I had teeth marks for about 6 years after that.
Where's Mikey now, Eric?
He's 6 feet under, sadly.
Is he?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, he was a great guy.
So, growing up in New England, now, okay, so was there an Armenian community? Because you talk about, there
wasn't. Well, in Watertown, where I was a little kid, yes, and there was the St. James Church, and that's where I was an altar boy, and I was an altar boy. And
Catholic?
No, Armenians are Armenian. Armenians are Armenian Apostolic. They have slightly different groupings, like especially down here in Southern California, you have the more political Armenians. They're one group, and then there's the guys that I came up with, which are like, but they're all Armenian. Armenian is the oldest Christian religion pretty much in the world. In 301 AD, the Armenians decided to become Christian.
Uh-huh.
Maybe at the time it seemed like a good idea.
Yeah. There's still a few people that remember Jesus or had a grandfather used to run with Jesus.
Oh, yeah. The first apostles went to Armenia. Yeah. That's where they went.
Right.
Bartholomew.
Guess we're out of work. We got to spread the word.
Unfortunately, a few hundred years later, you have the first giant Muslim empire, the Arabs. Mm-hmm. They don't really like Christians. And then they're followed by the Turkish Muslim empires, the Mongols. None of these guys are happy about
Christians. And it's still going on. It's insane.
Yes, sadly. On my way here today, I was thinking, we're going to talk about whatever it is we're going to talk about. And such bad shit is happening over there right now. I wish we, you know, I wonder to what degree, just if we can take 1 second to be a little political here. To what degree there's a kind of a racism against Middle Eastern people, that people don't care about what's happening to all these Syrian refugees. It's just some statistic. And especially for us as Americans who started all this crap in the first place, and why everybody's running all over the place over there. What are we doing to help them? You know, it's going to start getting cold out there in a month or so. And these are just families just stuck all over the place. In fact, it was this kind of thing that kicked in my feelings about what were my roots back when Serbia and Bosnia was happening in the 90s. I would watch these refugees coming out of these towns, and I'd say, that must have been what it was like for my family and my people, because this is what happens. They come in. These people are just living their life, not bothering anybody. They're not even political. They're not thinking about it.
No, they're just living.
And the next thing you know,
they're in the street.
An army shows up. They take all the men off, and they put a bullet in their head. And then they take all the women, and they do stuff with the women. And then who knows? I mean, in 100 years ago, the children were valuable, too. You could keep that child to be like a little slave for you, or could be your child.
Mm-hmm.
You could adopt the child.
Right.
So at any rate, I just think that we got to think about this is a major humanitarian
yeah.
screw up. And I wonder to what degree, because these people are Middle Eastern,
yeah.
nobody seems to care that much. I mean, people care. But
I don't know. Like, it might be that, but it's also just about American culture in general, that the, you know, the level of distraction and immediacy to people's lives, you know, and their concerns are selfish, but also complicated. I don't know that necessarily, you know, Americans are bad people or judging it as Middle Eastern. It's just not here.
Yeah, I think, but we started it. That's the thing.
I know, but you know,
I think
to
we
get people to take
responsibility.
Well, no, I'm not arguing with you, but I yeah. I don't know if
no,
that
I see what you're saying.
if that occurs on a personal level. I don't know that if the average American, if they really knew what was going on, I think they'd be like, "Well, I'd like to help," but I think the leap for an average personal, you know, one-on-one American to go like, "This is my fault," that's a different political issue, but a humanitarian movement, you know, certainly should people should be aware. But what I think is interesting about you is that you, early on in your career, have always been, you know, a voice of brutal satire of this country. So your awareness of what America is on not necessarily political level, on a cultural level, was intact, you know, from the beginning. And as you get older, now you get wiser and you get more empathetic and your heart gets bigger, you're able to sort of broaden that, the understanding of what America is responsible for on a global level, you know, into this awareness now and this work with Armenia. But like, when I think about you, you know, or whatever I project as who you were on the Lower East Side in 1980 or whenever the fuck that started.
Yeah.
That, you know, you were an angry, sweaty, you know, manic voice, you know, attacking America from the inside.
Classic angry young man who knows everything, knows better, and with great indignation, I'm telling everybody off, and I know what's right, and you don't know, and I'm going to tell you. Although I did it all, as you say, in satire,
and in
sarcastic,
and in
ass
character.
Backwards. You know, the whole idea was to create street people. By the way, I just want to tell you that those old monologues that I used to do, I have all my friends doing them now, and we have them online, 100monologues.com. I just want to tell you that we've been spending a couple of years. We've now got 50 of them, because it turned out over those 20 years, I had done 100 different bits.
Yeah.
And
characters, a lot of them.
Yeah. And somebody was saying one day, I don't know who it was, one of my friends said, you know, I could do one of those. And then we started shooting them and collecting
them. How do they hold up?
They're good. Yeah. They're funny.
Is
They're really
more
funny. Some are better than others. I mean, there's people on there like, I mean, Jen Tilly does one of the bits. Michael Shannon does one. Stuhlbarg does one.
I like that.
And they're funny.
That guy. So give me a sense of this, because this is like a piece of the New York puzzle that I have not talked to anybody that, you know, that era of performance, when I think performance art really started to have...
Don't say performance art to me, but okay.
No, just define itself. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not called stand-up comedy. You know, you can call it theater.
We call it performance. Let's call it performance.
That's fine.
Okay.
I'm just trying to, you know, the same people you want to take responsibility for Syria as Americans, we need to sort of broaden out, you know, performance art is what it is to them, but now they know it's performance.
All right.
But what was it? What was the scene? Because you come out, would you go to theater school and then go to New York? I mean, you're in Woburn. How the fuck did you decide?
I was a theater guy. I had never been to theater when I was a kid. When I was a teenager, we did theater one day in English class.
Right.
And I was like a fish to water. I was like, this is great. What is this we're doing?
What was it?
It was Shakespeare. We were doing Romeo and Juliet. I played Capulet. I yell at Juliet for getting home late all the time or whatever.
And you're I can yell.
I can yell. that was Woburn acting.
Right.
And they turned it, it was like a little drama club, and I started doing that. And it was just, you know, I really liken it to sports. Like, like everybody can play sports. Everybody can do theater. But there's always one guy who, for whatever reason, he can stand up there and he can hit six home runs and... in six games. And I just had an ability to do this. I think it was probably because I spent so much time when I was a kid locked in my bedroom talking to myself in the mirror. But at any rate, I lived in this fantasy world, and when I was given the opportunity, so there I am, an actor. Somebody says, you're an actor, you should be an actor, you should follow this. But I come from a very working class background where like, you don't go in the arts.
What'd your dad do?
He was a bookkeeper.
Right.
And my mom was a hairdresser.
You got brothers and sisters?
I got a younger sister. Yeah, she's great. She's a school teacher.
Uh-huh.
And so I didn't think it was a practical idea.
Right.
And I went off to college and I didn't do it. And I ended up doing theater again in college. And then eventually
just a theater group.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And then I finally said, okay, look, I dropped out because I was doing too much acid and stuff. And then I went back
to
college.
I like that it was acid. Yeah. That was your drug of choice. Yeah. Acid. That's
perfect.
That's a lot of work.
Don't worry. I worked my way into the more relaxing drugs after that.
Yeah.
And note, and I have to say this because I know that the youngins are out there listening, stopped everything 31 years ago. So,
wow.
And I totally
attribute. That's a big chunk.
Half my life,
yeah.
But I, for me, for this guy, for this junkie,
yeah.
I have to be clean and sober, or I can't do anything. I'm disabled.
Yeah,
it's a disability.
You give
me a beer, and I'm not gonna show up for work.
I get that, but like a lot of like, what year did you get sober?
84.
All right, so this is like, you know.
Oh, I've done. My kids say to me, "How come you do so much stuff about being high and on drugs and everything when you don't do any of that stuff?"
Yeah, anymore? But you did some fairly, you know, some of the very powerful work, the, you know, life defining work, you know, career changing work when you were fucked up.
But I subverted everything.
No, I'm not saying it's a good thing.
Dressing rooms. Yeah,
I get it. I'm sober too, and you know, we talk about that here. But it's sort of interesting that a lot of times people. And I'm not romanticizing it, but you had to hit the wall pretty hard and pretty publicly, and you certainly explored the negative sides and positive sides of drug use and drinking in your work before you cleaned up.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I don't regret it. I mean, I think, you know, that's everybody says that who's been down that route.
Sure.
The only problem, you want to survive it. You don't want to come out the other end like be in a box.
No,
that's no good.
On the right side of the grass, I think, or is it right? Is that what it's called?
The wrong side of the grass. You don't, under the roots.
Yeah.
Well, but, all right, so I gave up. I gave up the whole. When I came to New York, I was so intimidated as an actor. I graduated college, and
you just moved to New York.
I had come as a student, and then I decided I wanted to live here because it was just amazing. You're talking 1975. Mm-hmm. The city was insane.
It was like broken, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was living in Times Square, and I just thought this was the craziest, best thing I'd ever. I wanted to be here.
It was just chaos, pirates, criminals everywhere.
Absolutely. The cops would just leave at night, like 11 o'clock at night. They were gone, and everything just went into total chaos. And the trains and everything. And I was young, so I didn't care.
Yeah.
I thought this was really
And you romanticized it, I imagine.
Yeah. And I also was getting deeper into the adventure of drugs and everything.
So you go as a student and you check it out and you're like, holy shit, this is where it's happening.
But I can't compete as an actor, I feel. I give up.
Yeah.
And I end up in Soho around all these visual artists. So I come up.
This is when you move there.
Yeah. In 76, 77, I worked at a place called The Kitchen.
Right.
And all my friends were either composers, choreographers, or visual artists. I didn't have any theater guys.
But this was sort of the beginning of that artistic renaissance of sort of a whole new type of expression. There was an art scene in New York that, you know, wasn't like the painters of the, you know, 50s and 60s, that sort of evolved out of the you know, whatever the New York art scene was, and now was going into all these different areas and taking real chances, though, right?
Well, I'd gotten very minimal, and it had gotten very esoteric.
Like, who were the people when you got there?
Well, just prior to that, you basically Phil Glass is the king of music, or he's becoming...
Just starting, right?
And there's everything, Donald Judd and you know, really clean...
High-minded shit.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
My crowd is, you know, Robert Longo and Cindy Sherman and... Keith Haring was over in another neighborhood, but that's all. Everybody's making pictures of things, stuff that anybody can look at and go, oh, I get what this is. And we were having fun. We were also in the clubs like all the time. And this was just, what had happened.
What were the clubs, like CB's or the other ones? Like Mud Club
and Tier 3.
So at that places. Time, you know, you're
so
seeing.
So there's just a zillion young people showing up in New York just thinking, what crazy shit can
but
I make?
But all the music that's going on, that's the height of CBGB's, right? And that's like the whole New York punk thing. You know, music
just
is being redefined.
I showed up my thing. I was not hip to the punk thing until somebody said, we're going to go. And I'm like, I don't want to do that punk thing. After Hendrix died, I didn't want to go hear any more rock and roll. And they said, no, come with it. Come hear this thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think it was like, who was it? The Heartbreakers or something. Petty Heartbreakers.
No, Johnny Thunders.
Johnny Thunders. Yeah, yeah. And this stuff was like real down and
great.
Dirty rock and roll. Like Kansas City, Max's Kansas City. And that was what I was like, I love this. So and then I was just clubbing for the next three,
right,
4 years.
Right, but what was the creative process? When did it become apparent that you could, that there was a new theater happening, that performance was viable?
Well, it was all about a community. So there's all these lofts, and people are just doing the craziest stuff. Some of it's like real theater, some of it's like not real theater. Mm-hmm. Like Willem Dafoe's down the street doing
Worcester Group
stuff with Worcester Group.
Yeah.
And they're doing, and Spalding was around in those days.
Was he?
Of course.
That was the beginning of Spalding?
I saw Spalding when I first got to New York. He was already doing Tooth of Crime by Sam Shepard.
That's a hell of a play.
He was a great guy,
too. What a big play. What did he play in that?
He was Hoss.
Oh, yeah.
And he, and I went backstage. I was like, this kid.
Yeah.
I just want to tell you, I thought that was great. He goes, I said, could I, will you have a cup of coffee with me?
Yeah.
Which people ask me all the time. And he goes, no, but you can buy me a drink.
Right.
And we went to Magoo's, and he was incredibly, I never forgot the fact that this man was kind to me, and we were friends, sadly.
What did he tell you?
Tell me anything. I mean, what can you tell anybody? That's pretty much the smartest thing anybody could tell you is like, hey, kid, just go for it. You know, what can
do
you only
do,
you know.
Just do it, right.
That's what everybody has always said to me. That's what Oliver Stone said to me when I was writing Talk Radio, the movie of it. It was like, I don't know what to tell you. Just keep writing.
All right, so you see the Worcester Group.
It's no good now, but keep writing.
You're running around. There's all this vitality and weird shit going on. I'm sure you saw some stuff where you're like, oh, what is that shit?
Yeah, oh, all the time. But the main thing was we were entertaining each other.
Right.
We were like, who can make up some crazy shit that's going to make the other guys laugh? As opposed to, I'm going to make something that's going to go to Broadway. Or I'm going to make something that's going to be like commercially, and there's no commercially anything. You've got some nights 8 people in the audience.
Oh, I know,
people.
Yeah.
And I had one place one time, it was like 6 people and none of them spoke English. And I'm like playing to the guy who's taking the money at the coin buy.
Tough crowd.
And so I would be, when I was writing, I started creating these characters, these monologue things. And of course, it was like when I first started it, this was very intimidating. I mean, now people are so used to seeing this stuff, but to do an old bum or something, a really crazy yelling at you kind of bum, who had done that? You know, the only person who had, they always forget that Robert Klein was the guy who first started doing Street People when he did that bit, Please. Do you remember Please? Please!
Yeah.
He's this guy in the street. He did Junkies.
A comedian.
So
and then Pryor did it too.
Oh, well, in Pryor, these guys are a big influence on me. The energy, the like come out and, the first Pryor Live movie knocked me out. And I said, I want to do that kind of energy in a theater because I am so bored with what's happening in the theater. So I started doing this stuff in these little, and it was very aggressive.
Never thought comedy though. I think we've talked about this before. Like, because there wasn't really a comedy club scene there. So I'll give you a pass on that. But was there ever a thought to that?
Oh, there was, sure. Because at a certain point, they started lumping me together with the new comic scene, which was breaking.
Catch a Rising later. Star. Yeah.
Well, Gilbert was doing his stuff.
Richard.
And so they would say, you're part of this. Like Esquire wrote a piece about it or something. So I go, okay, I'm going to go do that. So I went to Catch. I stand up there and they have a green light and a red light. As soon as I started talking, they start blinking the red light. And I'm feeling like I'm being run over and mugged at the same. I could not do it. There's two things I will always have tremendous respect for. One, stand-up comics, which I can't do it.
Yeah.
And two, radio talking. I did the guy in the movie.
Right.
But to do it for real,
it's
fucking hard. It's hard. I've guested for people. They say, hey, why don't you take the show for a night? Vince Scalzo would have me do it.
Right.
And I'm trying to think of what to say, and I can't think of anything.
Yeah.
Because if I have a month to write a line for a character, then I'll play the guy.
Yeah, just to fill that dead air. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah. Oh, but it's... And also, I don't think people realize that everything you say, you've got to be ready to stand behind.
Yeah.
And if I have time to think about it, I can do that. But to be a guy who says, this is my view of life.
Yeah.
And I'm going to, it's going to be consistent and all. And
yeah, but a lot of times it becomes a character. You know what I mean?
It's all a character. Everything you do is a character. You're a character right now. I'm a character right now. I'm nothing like this in real life.
Yeah.
I'm completely,
I know. I know. You're quiet. you rarely talk.
Well, I was thinking about you with your cats, and I was thinking, if people could only see how I actually spend my day, I have plants.
Yeah.
I water my plants. And my big moment of the day is checking the mail to see if I got a residual check.
$4 from talk radio. It's running on some cable channel. I'm gonna get a coffee. All right, so you're doing this and you're like, I'm gonna bring this intensity, this energy, these characters to theater. And I imagine
I was in like a loft scene. I was in like all kinds of clubs.
What was that other one? That was the other loft where that lasted a long time. It wasn't the kitchen. It was somebody's. It seemed like someone lived there. It wasn't quite in Soho. It was upstairs, and they had a lot of performances.
Well, Arlene had her place.
What was it called?
I don't know, Arlene's or something. There were so many places.
Right, but that's where it took place. So when you're saying performing,
Lower East Side,
right? When you're performing for your friends, that was also a community of people that were interested in seeing this stuff. Yeah, so it wasn't just you and Spalding or you and Cindy or whoever.
People would know that something was happening and you'd all go see that thing. Eventually the neighborhood got so big that, you know, you could have 100 people or whatever, and eventually built. I think Laurie Anderson was the first one to start doing set shows repeatedly.
Uh-huh.
Which
in a loft situation?
Like usually you did one night and that was it, and then you never did that bit again. But she would make a particular show, and then I did the same. I started thinking, yeah, this is like a set show.
With several characters.
Yeah, I would do a dozen characters. Did Franklin Furnace, all these places, the kitchen. And
was the first show Drinking in America?
No. This is, the first show was called Men Inside, then Fun House, and then Drinking in America was the first one I did sober, which was like a hit show. And by then I was in real, by then Joe Papp had scouted me, brought me to the Public Theater. I'd done a couple of shows there. Then I did that at American Place. Because Joe said I couldn't come back and do any more solos at the Public because we don't do solos anymore. Then I do Drinking in America. It's a huge hit. And Joe Papp comes to the show and goes, why did you leave us? I said, well, you kicked me out. That's why. And
yeah.
He said, well, you come back and you can do whatever you want to do. You are in the slot now. January, whatever it is you want to do will open in January 1986. And I said, well, I have an idea for a thing about a talk radio guy. He goes, great. You got anything written? I had 20 pages.
Yeah.
I was already in their calendar for the next year.
And that was based on the Berg thing.
No, that came in later.
Oh, really?
Well, the guy that I created
was... Daniel Berg?
Alan Berg. Similar to the character I'd created for the play.
Right.
And when we were going to make the movie, I said to Ed Pressman, this is very complicated, but anyway, I said to Ed Pressman, there's a book about this guy who got gunned down in Colorado.
Uh-huh.
Denver. Colorado.
Yeah.
And we better buy this book because my play sounds so much like, believe me, I did not base the play on this guy.
Right.
But when we did the movie, I merged the two stories.
And you had optioned the book. So you were able to do it.
Yeah, we had the book as was part of our package.
And you had Creepy Rockets Red Glare come in at the end.
Rockets. Poor old Rockets. He was so great. Yeah, Did you know Rockets?
I saw him towards the end.
Yeah.
Around, because I was living on second between A and B in 89. 89 to 91, 92. And I don't remember where I saw him, but I was excited. And I didn't even know what his place in the whole scheme of things was, but I knew he was in that your movie, and I knew he was sort of a guy.
Rockets was a famous character of the scene, big junkie,
right,
and kind of a doorman at various places.
Uh-huh.
The secret to Rockets, which I only knew from working with him, was that his brother had been one of the people who like established Microsoft or something and had cut off a chunk of stock for him that cost 2 cents, had given it to him, had become worth all this money.
Right.
And then he was able to keep up his junkie life based on Microsoft stock or something.
So you sort of this something like that. That's a great thing about New York that you don't see a lot in the same way, is that there are actual characters within the scene that don't necessarily do anything, but they're an organic part of the scene that add to the whole sort of energy of the environment. Yeah. And that happens a lot in New York. It's like, that's that guy, you know?
Well, we had such a huge community of amazing people, and when AIDS came, it just was
leveled.
Oh my God, it was horrible. The people we lost, so many beautiful people.
Yeah,
Ethel Eichelberger,
Herring,
Klaus Nomi, Herring, mm-hmm. So many, and then the dope did its job too on mm-hmm. a few people, and so yeah, it was. But I don't know if that always happens or doesn't happen to community. It was truly.
Well, I think it's a singular event,
horrible.
The Lower East Side. I think that, you know, what happened there, and because it's never recovered from it, and it sent generations searching for it, you know, for decades after what you guys started, you know, like long after when I was there in the 90s, there was still this sort of like the residual idea of living a performance life on the Lower East Side, but it didn't have the vitality or the originality necessarily that you guys had because you were at the epicenter of it.
And it was cheap. We had cheap housing. I mean, yeah. It comes down to, like, if you don't have to pay that much in rent.
If you can live there, right.
You're 23 years old, of course you're going to live a rock and roll existence.
But between you and Spalding, and I guess I think in some weird way, you know, Karen Finley brought a lot of attention to, you know, what was going on down there.
Yeah.
But in a way that people were able to mock it. Because I don't, performance art became this, like, what are you going to put yams in your pussy? You know, so it sort of got minimized by mainstream culture because of characterization.
Well, Saturday Night Live did that amazing bit that time where they were like making fun of it. World Federated Performance Art or something. And Adam Sandler's pretending to be me and he has like a curly wig on and he's doing something like my bits. And
I think that anytime something happens, you know, culturally that can be seen as show business, whether you want it to or not, and it isn't show business, then show business is eventually going to gut it.
Yeah.
They're either going to steal it or they're going to gut it.
Well, what was weird is it became very successful. I mean, by the time I did Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll in 90 or 91 or something, I mean, we rolled up the biggest advance on an off-Broadway show ever.
I saw that show 4 times.
Oh, my God.
It was weird because, like, I always had a little bit of a problem with you. I was like, you know, is he a comedian? What the fuck does that guy? No, I don't. what does that guy do? You know, because I was like, you know, diehard comic. And I'm like, he just wants to be a comic, you know. And then I went to see, because I'd read about you and I'd seen talk radio by that point, and I'd never seen you live before. But then for some reason, I went to see it and you were still workshopping it. It was at the place where Stomp was, right?
That became where the Orpheum.
Right.
Yeah.
So I saw it in some version, and then I, you know, in a smaller place. I don't know where.
PS-122, I used to do all my stuff
right,
with them.
Right.
We're going to do a benefit over there in a couple
so
weeks.
So, like, and then I saw all these different characters, and I'm like, holy shit, this guy's great. And then, like, you know, I watched some of the characters, then I went to see it again, and some of the characters were gone, and I was thinking there, like, why did he take that guy out? You know, what happened to that guy? And then, and then when I saw it finally at the Orpheum, I'm like, so this is the final show, but I still was sort of like, wow. I missed that one guy. Where's that guy? The one guy, I still remember which guy I miss.
Was the doctor with the prescriptions?
No, it was the guy with the bong. Like, I'm a rebel. You remember, you know, like the guy who was like the outlaw, but he was just sitting on his couch smoking a bong.
Oh my God, I don't even remember.
You don't? And then there was the guy with the Coke can. Like, I have a huge cock. That guy stayed in, though, that guy,
oh,
right?
He was great. Yeah. Down. I've got a long, thick, well-shaped prick the kind girls die for.
Yeah.
You're laughing. So what?
Yeah.
Fuck you.
Yeah, yeah. And he's just sort of like,
well,
because
isn't that everybody's fear? Is right, that like there's some guy, you know,
who's a moron, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's no good at work. He has no money.
but
he can get any woman.
Yeah, yeah. Those guys are
massive schlong.
But after that, I was sort of like, wow, this guy's, you know, really something. You don't need this validation, but that was my. All right, so it all builds up to Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. That was, but was that before talk radio? Was after, right?
Right after, yeah. That was sort of like the pith of everything going really right for me right then. I did that, and then a couple of years later, I did Pounding Nails in the Floor at My Forehead, which I even like better.
I saw that show too.
And Suburbia at Lincoln Center,
right?
And then I did the Seagal movie around the same that 1994. It was hitting all the cylinders full blast.
And when did you meet your wife? Your wife's a theater director,
80.
Right?
We've been married 35 years.
So she met you drunk,
Joe Bonney.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm drunk, more than drunk. And I said to her, this is my lifestyle. This is who I am. Take it or leave it. And she would like cry and stuff. It was sad. And then 4 years later, I mean, she's getting up every morning at 8 o'clock to go to work. I'm still like out of it. And I'm, hey, some people need 10 hours of sleep a night. You know, it's
that
medically
guy. Yeah,
necessary.
Horrible man.
Terrible. And then it just, I don't even know what happened. I mean, somebody just said, you know, how are you doing? And I said, everything's great.
Yeah,
I
right.
Had, like, no income.
With
I'm
your
dead
sniffling.
I'm waking up with sweats every morning.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, come with me to the, you know.
To the thing.
To the thing.
Yeah, the secret society.
The secret society.
I know, I talk about it.
But it's, and that was the what a mitzvah, right? So,
yeah.
And then
said
things,
the Armenian guy.
Yeah. And it's honorary. I'm going to, you can come to my bar mitzvah.
Okay, it'll good. Like, let me know when it is. Yeah. I'll write you a check. I'll give you an Israeli bond. I'll give you $25 Israeli savings bond.
In a tree. You'll buy, give me a tree in Israel.
Get you a tree. So, but you collaborate with her too, right? A lot?
Well, she directed all those early shows, and then she sort of peeled off and was direct, not and sort of, she peeled off, did her own shows, and now she's one of the premier directors in New York. She does stuff with, you know, Neil LaBute and Susan Laurie Parks and Lynn Nottage, all the big, very, very smart Pulitzer Prize winning
now from
writers.
from that era, do you know how many friendships do you maintain? Are you friends with Cindy Sherman? Are you still like close to the core group? I mean
we don't see each other all the time. I mean, you get older and you have slightly, sure, but yeah, we do see each other. We all love each other very much.
So there's still
my circle of friends is sort of enlarged into another world of all the theater and even movie and TV people who are just kind of my pals. I basically play poker now, so that's what I do. That's who my circle of friends are.
Do you play cards once a week?
Almost once a week. But like an actor guy, Liev got me started in this thing when we were doing talk radio on Broadway. And he said, I'm having a poker game. And it's like, I don't gamble. I don't play poker. I don't do anything. I don't like the numbers, nothing. And that was seven years ago. I'm sick into it now.
Right. Well,
I'm
we really want you to come. And and then you lost hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
Until you figured
out. The problem was I won that night. And that was that.
Oh, that got you in?
Since then, I've lost nonstop.
They always love the guy, especially in an established game. If you go, like, I don't really know how to play. Oh, you really got to come.
Yeah.
And then they all know each other's tells, but you don't even know what a tell is. And you're fucking, you leave broke because you lucked out the first night.
Yeah, and I've played everybody, and it's a lot of fun. But
so how do you get from, like, you know, you do sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you're starting to do movies, you're writing books, I mean, you write novels too.
Yeah, that was after the play thing kind of stopped in the late 90s. I had kept writing plays, I still write plays, but they just weren't getting produced. And so I was fascinated by, I mean, there's all kinds of things that the internet have changed things. And, and the fact that you could buy a book anywhere, it changed the
or
way.
Or watch people fucking on your phone.
But you could.
It's a big, it's an amazing world we live in.
Well, so you can get a book to somebody in Nebraska that they couldn't get at their local bookstore. And that changed everything. I mean, David Foster Wallace and all the kind of great stuff that was coming in that period, Dave Eggers.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know. I like books, so I'm gonna write. So I started writing books, and I wrote three novels, and I don't think I ever found that audience. But the thing about a book is, it's still there.
Yeah.
And I had been doing so much ephemeral stuff.
Look at around us. There's so many of these books here, and you know what? I haven't read most of them. Don't tell anybody.
But
a few of them I've read.
Read the book that I gave you.
I will.
That Perforated Heart is so like navel gazing existential.
What are you saying, like, Eric? Look, I got through it. Maybe it'll help you. don't kill my voice, man.
Also, I think you can do things when you're young that you can't do when you're old, and there's things when you can do when you're older. So I can do long form now and have the presence of mind to stick with it until I have 300 pages done. Whereas when I was writing those short things, I had a million ideas, but I couldn't. I could never complete. So that's about all I could do was about a 3-minute monologue, and I could write that and work on that. And now I'm in this other zone where maybe my ideas aren't so great, but I can write something very
long. You have
long.
Discipline. You have a different type of patience. You have creative confidence in a way.
And I had been writing all through this period. Once I did talk radio, I was working for the man here in Hollywood.
Right.
Like I did, you know, numerous,
right? Or one of them?
No, I was an actor in CI for Law and Order. That was more recent, but just I worked as a screenwriter for, you know.
Oh, yeah? Like a doctor? Give it to Bogosian?
Or get a book or something and you adapt it. I mean, none of them got made into movies, but I got paid in WGA, so like you got health benefits and stuff.
Yeah.
So that was like my invisible job.
Right.
Nobody knew I was doing.
Right.
And I did that for about 15, 20 years and was good.
Yeah. You know, you have kids, right?
I have two boys, yeah.
How old are they?
28 and 24.
Holy shit.
Yeah, holy shit is right. So they're like...
How they doing?
Great.
Good.
Yeah, they're not in college anymore. So now I can start to do my own life again, run around.
Do you hang out with them?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's... I'm not going to say... I mean, my relationship with my parents was fine, but it was typical of that time, which is they're the parents and I'm the... But I had that completely.
I love you, but fuck you. I gotta go.
Yeah, and I'm angry at them, and I'm not around, and I go away for a long period of time. But my guys, I mean, I spent a lot. First of all, I'm the generation of dads who spent a lot of time changing diapers and doing all that stuff with the, and always around them. My wife was working a lot, so I'm with, and so now there are these men that I have a relationship with I don't have with anybody else. And you know what? They make me laugh. And
that's
all
great.
That's all I care about in relationships.
And they don't know drunk
if you
Eric.
Didn't make me laugh.
Right?
No, yeah. Never.
That's great.
Yeah, they didn't never see me drunk.
They heard the story.
They saw me rageaholic, though. I was early on when I was first getting sober and they were a little, yeah. Daddy could get a little, they call me crazy daddy. And everybody would like leave the room because I'm going nuts.
How'd you deal with that? Because I, you know, like I'm just reckoning with that now in the last few years, you know, at 16 years sober, the rage problem finally exhausted itself. It literally yeah,
that's
exhausted.
About when it, that's about when it burns out. Well, more and more, there's less and less to like, what am I being so freak? What am I so crazy about?
What
Why am I so afraid?
Of? Yeah.
What am I afraid of?
Yeah.
For me, it came to a sudden end because a friend of mine's son died from a drug overdose when he was like 18 years old, one of my best friends. It was mind-blowing.
Heartbreaking.
Just, and it changed my whole notion of what's important, what isn't important in my life, and what am I losing my shit over this? Because he didn't do the Spanish homework?
Right.
Who cares?
Right.
And so I just stopped. I just said, "This. Right. I don't care." Because it was all about fear, like they're not going to get into college or something. And
right.
It's like,
oh, right.
Wait, really?
Right.
You never cared about this shit in the first place. Why is this something that you're losing? You're going nuts. And so I just stopped. I said, if this kid ends up on the couch for the rest of his life smoking weed, which they never did any of that stuff.
But it's interesting
it's okay.
What kicks in, you know, despite whatever you grew up with, there is that idea that you want your kids to have a opportunity to, you know, to find their way in the world, to do the responsible thing, even if they're, you know, they think that they don't want it now. There is that, I imagine, with a kid where it's sort of like, you may think that you want to be this way now, but you're going to regret it.
Yeah.
And you, there must have been some shame you were carrying.
Well, we had more frank conversations than I ever had with my parents. I mean, I would say to him, like Harry, when he was 12 or something, I said, look, I just want to tell you this. This is my first time being a dad. Okay.
Right.
So you got to cut me some slack here. Just go with it a little bit. Right. Mm-hmm. And I would say stuff like, you know how you kind of feel weird around girls and you're shy? Smoke weed, it'll be like multiplied by 10. So if you want it to be a lot worse, start smoking a lot of grass and then you'll never talk to a girl again. And it's great because he was, he had a girlfriend and he got laid a lot more than I did when I was his
age. And that's a whole other problem.
Yeah.
Like,
that's
how'd you
called
do it?
Statutory you... rape, Harry. You can't do that.
So you've had all these different sort of lives creatively, you know, as a performer and actor, screenwriter, novelist, and collaborator with other people and stuff. And so I imagine this brings us to this point where, you know, you want to own your heritage. And then this book, like, I just have to assume that, and I'm projecting, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, that, you know, when this thing started to blossom and sort of, you know, reveal all these things to you, not only about the Armenian genocide or about the history, that your sense of family and everything else must have just kind of converged as well on this, you know, in the sense.
Oh, sure.
Right.
Well, I mean, you respect what it, look, when you're a kid, old guys are just old guys.
You love
them. They're not that into,
right.
But they don't seem to have, and then you go, oh, I get it. He went through all this stuff. This is what being this guy is. I mean, for me, it was a reversal of, I had rejected myself as a sort of ethnic, I was not going to be this ethnic
guy. Sure, yeah, exactly.
And then as I, and more recently, I'm like, no, you are, you know, own it,
yeah.
Love it. The music, the food. You know, when I was like little, when I was in the 60s, if I ate yogurt or something,
yeah.
Which is an Armenian
yeah.
food,
matzun
we call yeah. it, the little kids in the neighborhood, they watch me eating it. Like, how do you eat? How can you eat that stuff?
Right,
that's
right.
So, ugh.
Disgusting.
And now everybody eats yogurt, shish kebab, all the things that were things I grew up with that were so weird and foreign. But that's me,
yeah.
You know? Now, we are a pretty I said this earlier, but I mean, Middle Eastern people are
yeah.
kind of like endlessly put down in our society. And that's what I look like. I look like a guy who's an Arab or a mm-hmm. Jew or whatever.
Yeah.
And I have to kind of get past that. You know, it's weird. We live in a society, I actually said this to Spike Lee one time, where black people can be like heroes and white people are heroes, but brown people aren't, you mm-hmm. know? And I think that's changing. That's changed lately. But pretty much the United we in our society, every country we have ripped off, we claim that they're the ones that are doing, like the Arabs are the sneaky people because we've been stealing their oil for like 75 years. The Mexicans are lazy.
They pay for it.
You know, all these people are, they're somehow bad or less than us. Black people are violent. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. There's like, black culture is not, black culture is actually more warm and embracing than other cultures that I know of.
So now
so we put down all these people, and I accept this idea of who I am in some way kind of less than. That's crazy. It's just, it is a little hard for me. One of the things about having kids is that I look at my boys and they are beautiful and wonderful. And I remember when I was their age, I was so self-conscious about my hair, this curly hair, people come up like touch it. My skin is a little darker than other kids. And I look at my kids, I go, how could I have ever thought that about myself? What a horrible thing.
So the act of Operation Nemesis, the act of creating this book, not only, it's an act of integration, yourself into your heritage and also the history of what you're talking about into the fabric of our culture. That, you know, you're raising awareness, and also now you're a celebrated Armenian, I would imagine. I mean, you're here to...
The community, particularly the people who are... The Armenian community has a very political side and a very non-political side. And the political side, I was never part of that world. The Armenian National Committee, who are actually having this big banquet this weekend and are honoring me with giving me an award, they have been so supportive. They are also... the people who made sure everyone was aware of the Armenian genocide, the centennial of it last April, which just happens, I don't know if this is some kind of mark or something, but I was born on April 24th, which is the day that they commemorate the beginning of all the killings. At any rate, I've gotten to know these communities that are super tight Armenian communities here in Southern California, all over the place. I was in Vegas the other day there. I was like visiting the church there. And
do they think you got it right?
You know, I was very wary of that as I was working on the book, because I'm talking about some stuff that they were involved in 100 years ago. And finally I gave it to them. And in March, some of the big guys in the community took me aside at this event and they said, we're with you.
Yeah.
We like the book. And supported it and have told all their people to read it and buy it, and so forth.
This is a new story to a lot of Armenians, I would imagine.
Absolutely, yeah. The old story, the original Tetlerian story of the kid, the engineering student who shot Talat Pasha in Berlin, is a story that a lot of Armenians know. The story of Operation Nemesis, that there was this huge conspiracy operating out of New England that knocked off six major Turks, who, by the way, like I say, if you're going to talk about the Armenian genocide, you got to mention that 5 years later they did this. That's news to a lot of people. And I think it's interesting, not just as an Armenian, but in terms of world history. I don't know of any story. I mean, Munich is kind of related to it, but they basically knocked off a whole government.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like if a Jew had found Hitler and Goering and Goebbels and all these guys and killed them.
Wiesenthal, he tried.
Yeah.
Yeah, he got a few.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it has the same kind of, like with Eichmann going into another country and doing this thing. This is not legal.
Right.
So you're stuck with this thing of like, it's kind of illegal. It's not kind of. It is illegal what they're doing.
War criminals.
They're kind of murder incorporated going after these guys.
Oh, you mean them? Yeah.
And then there's this sort of sense of like, what is God? What's
justice?
And then justice. Mm-hmm. And then you basically say, what's right?
Mm-hmm.
And if these guys are really, and they are responsible for murdering a million people, then some people felt it was their job to go and hunt them down.
Not let them get away with
it. Or maybe come back to power later and keep killing more Armenians, which was another part of it.
Well,
they had, by the way, I have to say, they had already been condemned to death by trials after the war. There were war crimes trials, and all these men had been, it was already established in court in Turkey. But at any rate, this story blew me away. I didn't know it. I honestly, working on it, I thought I was going to get it done a lot faster than... I'm good friends with Sarah Vowell, and she was sort of like rabbied me through this thing a little bit. And so I thought, oh, I can write a popular history. I'll just learn all the facts and then I'll kind of put it in my own voice. But it turned out to be a much more serious and hard thing. So about halfway through it, I realized I was really in deep with a complicated story. But what are you going to do? You got to finish it. So I kept going. And
it's good you had that discipline. And you wrote something
that
could...
I really had nowhere else to go. I mean, I had to finish. What, are you going to climb a mountain and go halfway?
It's going to be a text.
It is a text. And there's an audio book too. So it's me reading, and I don't know how to pronounce any of these Armenian names. So it's just insane trying to say all this stuff. I don't even know how to pronounce my own last name. You know, it's like, it's Bogosian, Bogosian.
What is
Bohosian.
It?
Well, the correct pronunciation is Bohosian.
Yeah, that's a little too true. Who?
Well, I used to do, when I did like talk shows and stuff when I first started my career, they'd be like, today we have Eric how do you say that name? I mean, I'm like, come on.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to have me on as a guest if you're going to do this
it's
to
hard.
Me.
I get it all the time. Marin, Moran, Moron. Yeah. Fucking horrible. Mine, I think, is simple. It's a lot less complicated than yours.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what part of New England did these guys work from?
Boston. Then there was a guy in Albany. There was a CPA in Albany. There was an insurance agent in Hartford, Connecticut.
Oh, my God.
And they were all part of the same political party. And they basically said, this has to happen.
It reminds me of the Cubans, too, that with the plot to kill Castro. Like, there are these expats who you know, want to take, you know, do what's right.
So they knew that this kid, Soleiman Tetlerian, had shot and killed somebody in Constantinople who was seen as sort of a traitor. And they recruited him. They brought him to Boston. They looked him over because they knew they wanted him to get caught so that then in the trial, he could talk about the Armenian genocide. They wanted people to hear about it. So they needed a guy who would be presentable. And he was a very sympathetic character with this.
Did he know he was going to get caught?
Yeah. The plan was to get caught and to go and then get as many witnesses into the trial as possible to talk about the Armenian genocide, which is what they did. So this was a very famous trial in 1921. New York Times covered it. It was covered all around the world. And this guy was so sympathetic because everybody thought that he had been the survivor of these massacres. He had seen his mother beheaded right in front of him. And he was just this engineering student, happened to see this guy in the street and went and got a gun. Of course, none of that was true. He knew exactly what he was doing. In fact, I even referred to a CIA manual on how to kill people, and the way he killed the guy, which was to shoot him in the back of the neck, right at the top of the spine, that is the most effective way to make sure that your victim shot.
He killed all six of them?
No, he killed him, and then there were other assassins who were operating all around Europe. There were all kinds of people. There were Armenians who spoke Turkish who pretended to be Turks, and there was one guy who actually got circumcised so that when he was in like the hammam, that Turks, if they saw him, they would think that he was Muslim, because Muslims get circumcised like Jews do. And
right,
all
right.
So he, anyway, all these different guys were all over the place. In Rome, they knocked a guy, they got the Grand Vizier. They went back to Berlin. They killed two more guys there. They got somebody in Constantinople. They got Jamal Pasha in Tbilisi. And they basically, one other guy got caught. He also got cut loose based on some idea of temporary insanity. And they basically grew up, most of them are old men here in California by the 1960s. There's pictures of them hanging around each other. I can show you in the picture, this guy killed two people, this guy killed three people, this guy killed...
Wait, out here, like in Glendale?
San Francisco, Los Angeles.
Well, so they kept in touch?
Yeah, oh yeah, they knew who each other. Although they didn't talk about it. One of the interesting things about this whole thing was it sort of came out of nowhere. These were all nobodies. They were all like, nobody ever knew these people. And then once they shut the operation down, they basically put all the stuff away and didn't talk about it ever again. So when I heard this story, it was like, what?
Mm.
And where's the book on this? Where's something about this? And I couldn't. There was this one obscure book coming out of France by Jacques de Rogy. And I used that for some source. And then I did my own research. Found out that British intelligence probably helped these guys out. British intelligence wanted these Turks killed as well. And they thought, well, we could kill them, or we could just tell the Armenians where they live.
Mm-hmm.
And so they I think they slipped the address to the Armenians.
It's fascinating because, like, you know, you did this great service for the community and for history and for everything else. And you just, you know, the impetus was like, I'm going to write a movie. And then then all of a sudden it became a bigger responsibility. Yeah. It became a humanitarian responsibility.
Well, I don't know.
Obviously, whatever the compulsion was, you were like, how has this story not been told properly?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't an... I didn't see how there was no upside for ego. There was no money upside. I mean, Little Brown paid me in advance, but it wasn't that was like in it for that.
How did that feel for you, doing something relatively selfless?
I don't know why I do anything. I just do stuff. I mean,
You're too sober to say that.
No, listen, I did. I met Mike Judge. When I was working with Richard Linklater, I met Mike Judge down in Austin.
Yeah.
I said, I love Beavis and Butthead to America. Beavis and Butthead. And if you ever want anything, he goes, well, we're going to do this movie, Beavis and Butthead to America. And so I said, well, anything. So he had me do 3 voiceovers in that movie, you know, scale 500 bucks or something. And I forgot about it. And, you know, whatever it was, $50,000 later, with all the royalties and everything, because the movie was a huge, in fact, it's probably the biggest hit I've ever been involved with. But I try to lead with, well, let me put it this way. I try to lead with have fun, keep things interesting. And every time I try to do something for money or I got this big plan.
Yeah.
I wrote an action movie one time because I thought I would sell it and get millions of dollars. Never works out.
Yeah.
All those plans don't work out.
Right. Good.
I'm no good with the plans. I started a production company. I was going to make a live video, which exists. Spent $60,000 on this thing.
Yeah.
Nothing. Couldn't get anyone. Nobody wanted it. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go on the 100monologues.com site and see those.
So you're doomed to operate from your passion.
I'm doing the having being clueless. I just don't know.
You get possessed.
The first thing I...
Right. You're a compulsive person. I mean, nobody writes an Armenian history book just because, you know, like, I think I'm going
to... It just makes sense to me. You know, when I'm working on anything, writing, and I know you've had this experience, it quickly becomes a dead end, or it like opens up like a flower. And you
right,
go,
right.
Oh,
wow.
Oh, I found this thing. This works.
That's what you're looking for.
Yeah.
That's the moment.
Yeah.
You can hope for that, but you can't plan it, is basically what you're saying.
No, you don't know what... And I don't know where it's coming from, and I've kind of given in to let's see what happens.
Sure.
It makes life a little more exciting because since I'm not planning everything, who knows what's going to be next year? You take the Law and Order thing. I mean, my friend Warren Light calls me up one day and says, come over to the offices today and say hi to everybody. I go, I'm really busy today. I can't come over. He goes, well, Dick's here. Come over and say, Dick Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
I said, he goes, I really think you should come over and say hi to Dick. So I come over. Dick Wolf says hi to me and says, do you want to be the captain on Law and Order? And 60 episodes later, I've had the time of my life and it was a blast doing that thing. Did not see that coming.
And you made a living doing what you do.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah, I was having cups of coffee, walk in the room, say 4 lines, drink a cup of coffee, and get to be in that beginning, the header of the show. What do they do?
Dum-dum. And you wrote this amazing book about this untold Armenian.
That paid for it. That paid for the book.
It's an exciting life you lead, and Operation Nemesis just came out a few months ago, right?
Yeah.
And you are an active part of a community that you through youthful condescension detached from, and now you have done this amazing gift.
Now I
for
realize
them.
How lucky I am to be one of these amazing people called Armenians. So that's what I am.
All right. Well, it was great talking to you, Eric.
Thanks, Mark.
That's it. That's the show. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Did I tell you? I mean, Eric goes, man. That was great. It's always good to see him. It's exciting. Yeah, talking to Eric Bogosian is like being on an amusement park ride. Good times. What else do I got to tell you? WTFpod.com. You know, get your stuff. Do the thing. If you want posters for Christmas, it's getting tight. It's getting tight now. You know, we might be able to make it under the wire. Don't know. But enjoy yourselves, and I'll talk to you Monday. Got some big shows coming up. What else? I got to brush my teeth and get dressed and go be an actor, do a character that's vaguely like me. It's a little muted jazz trumpet for the end. Yep. Boomer lives! We'll be right back. Hey, folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.